human beings share a lot of things with the rest of the animal kingdom, and one of those things is our basic primal desire to pass our genes along. Our advanced primate brain, however, has taken us far beyond the simple need to find a mate. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Happy Valentine's Day. Today, on this day that we celebrate romantic love with flowers, chocolate, cards, and candlelit dinners, we are going to explore the anthropology of love. We'll find out if the phenomenon of romantic love is universal among humans or if it varies from culture to culture. We'll talk about the relationship between love and marriage and love and sex. We'll also take a look at the evolution of courtship and modern dating, including online dating. We'd love to hear from you as well. Please join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. On this day that we celebrate love with flowers, cards, and candy, we're going to spend the next hour exploring the anthropology of love. Human beings are driven, like most creatures, to seek mates and to procreate, but the concept of romantic love goes well beyond our primal urges. With me today are two people who have dedicated their careers to studying love, sex, and marriage in different cultures around the world, including our own, of course. Teresa Downing-Mattebeg is an associate professor of sociology at Iowa State University. Hello, Teresa.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks for being here today. And also, Sonia Ryan is a professor of anthropology and international studies at the University of Iowa. Hello, Sonia.
Hello. Happy to be here.
Teresa, I want to start with you, and this is a big question, but what is love? How can we define it?
What is love? Well, I guess that's a really open question, but I can share two of my favorite definitions of love. One is from Sternberg, and he claims that love involves intimacy, passion, and commitment. And I really like that because it mixes that tingly feeling that we have with romantic love alongside the realization that, yeah, we might not always have those, you know, highs and all of those endorphins spinning when we meet our loved one, but commitment is what really keeps us there through thick and thin.
And Sonia, from the viewpoint of an anthropologist, humans certainly have this need to pass their genes along to procreate. We need partners to rear our young. So I guess we need the intimacy and we need the commitment that Teresa was talking about. But what purpose does romantic love fill for us?
I'm not sure. You see, romantic love is not, it's kind of relatively new. And anthropologists have consistently failed to confer this particular form of love amongst the so-called primitives and the savages that they originally studied. That's how anthropology began. And they didn't really find romantic love among non-literate people. In other words, conversely, anthropologists tended to associate romantic love only with literate people, with so-called higher civilization. Now, that is now being very, very much revised, but not so effectively, as much as I would like to see.
So we probably, most of us, would think about romantic love as being very old because we know we have sonnets and love
right.
songs and Shakespeare's
right.
plays and all of that. But you're looking at a grander scale of time, obviously. Do we have an idea about when this kind of romantic love might have originated?
I'm not sure. You see, I'm not sure if I'm actually looking at the grander scale of time because time-space is a little differently configured. Of course, if we look at only Western history, yes, maybe the love, romantic poems and things like that started in Shakespearean, some people might say. But if you look at Shakespeare itself, contemporary to Shakespeare, you know, the people that were contemporary to Shakespearean sonnets and so on, they didn't necessarily register this as romance. I don't think Romeo and Juliet had such a romantic tone like we actually currently appreciate. It's been evolved. When you look at the so-called non-literate people that anthropologists have studied, even early 20th century, they didn't really associate romantic love. They only saw, for example, the sexual life of, for example, one of the very classical anthropological works by Bronislaw Malinowski, who is widely seen as founding fathers of anthropology. He studied these Trobriand Islanders. It's off Australia for about 2 years because he was stranded there during the First World War because he was the Austrian national studying in the British university. So he wrote this massive book. The content of it is very much about courtship and lovemaking among these people called Trobriand Islanders. But the title of that book is The Sex Life of the Savages. So that's all he saw. He saw sex life among the savages rather than romantic love among, say, non-literate people or among Trobriand Islanders. So this notion of romantic love kicks into anthropology, discipline of anthropology, rather very, very recent, actually.
Well, that's very interesting. And, of course, in sociology, it's something that we talk about all the time because human beings do tend to be obsessed with romantic love. Teresa, do you have an opinion or about what role romantic love fills for us?
Well, yes, and I'd like to say that in America, we started thinking more about love and romance as a basis for relationships, really, with the American Revolution. And it seems as if in our drive for freedom against British rule, we also had a concurrent drive for greater freedom in our relationships. And in 1910, actually, dating was invented in America, as we know it. It was invented during the Victorian era by the lower class, and they decided to date and go out together as young couples because they didn't have the big Victorian houses where they could meet in their parlors, as did the middle and upper class during that time. So romantic love, I think its evolution has really been driven by a human desire to connect with, you know, another person on an emotional level, and especially in America in the post-industrial era. And, you know, as I said, you know, the Industrial Revolution really freed us up in this country, at least, from, you know, the family farm and needing to conform to the social norms in the community and strict parental control, and enabled young people to go out into the workforce on their own and be more independent and thus able to be more, you know, better able to independently choose their partners.
Well, that's so interesting because obviously when we were throwing off the monarchy, we wanted to throw off all other kinds of control as well. The American idea of self-determination and choosing your own mate, that is something that certainly is seen elsewhere around the world today. But how did it spread around the world?
Yes,
Teresa, do you have an idea about that?
I really do agree with Sonia that it's a relatively new invention. In many ways, it's a social construction. You know, we decide that we're going to have this great freedom in choosing our partners. It spread, of course, in Western Europe with the Industrial Revolution there and then in America as well. And given the tremendous influence of, you know, of Western culture especially, you know, the ideas about romantic love have been spread through the media, now through the internet, through the various travels in which we engage in our global society. And I think that what we're seeing today is that in countries that are more rapidly developing, if you look at China, for example, you know, the idea of romantic love is becoming ever more popular.
In Japan, for example, you can actually nail down the certain period when romantic love became kind of norm. As you know, Japan was occupied by the U.S. forces between 1945 and 1952. And then it's definitely after that occupation that Japanese young people became much more, you know, took it as a norm to fall in love with someone who they choose rather than going through arrangement marriage and then date and then get into marriage. The typical example was that the crown prince of the first crown prince's marriage to, say, so-called commoner woman was supposed to have been born from, you know, within romantic love. And that was 1950s. So it's around that time. I think in Japanese context, you can actually nail down a very clear influence of the U.S. occupation.
Well, so that really did spread directly from the United States.
Yes, you may say so, but it, you know, you can say that I don't think it will be exclusively because of the U.S. occupation, but it played a very big role in that.
Well, let's go back. Let's talk about that time period, and about 50 years ago, 1950s, and even into the 1960s in the United States. Let's talk about courtship, because we've gone back now to the Industrial Revolution and the invention of dating. But let's take a look at courtship in, real, I guess, the 1950s, because things changed so dramatically in the 1960s. But for those of us who have not experienced the life of the 1950s, what would courtship have been like, and what was new about it in the 1950s? Teresa?
Well, the 1950s, that is a very interesting era in U.S. history. And as we all know, we came out of World War II as the world's, you know, economic power. And during that era, in the post-World War II era, which, of course, included much of the 1950s, we had a situation where young men could graduate from high school, go get a job, and support a wife and, you know, kids, and have a little house in the suburbs. And the U.S. government actually subsidized young men coming home from the military. They subsidized their housing and encouraged them to live in this new American suburbia. Of course, there was a lot of exclusion during that period because not everyone had access to the benefits that the government was offering. But nevertheless, during this era, it was not at all uncommon for young people to start dating in high school. And for the young man to give his girlfriend his class ring, and then for them to go on and become engaged and married. And if they decided to go to college, a lot of girls went to college in order to find someone to marry who was college educated. And so they would become engaged during college. And oftentimes the young men would decide they wanted to get married when they graduated. And if the women weren't yet graduated, they just dropped out.
Well, and I think we probably all know people who took that pathway in our families and in our lives. Sonia, around the world, now, of course, many people still do get married right out of high school or right out of college in the United States, but we've started to think about that as getting married young. When we take a look at other cultures around the world, what kinds of age ranges do we see for people actually getting married and choosing a life partner?
That's very interesting. For example, in Japan and especially in Korea, the marriage age is becoming older and older. And in fact, marriage itself is becoming fewer and fewer. People are not taking. For example, girls do not take necessarily that they have to get married in order to survive. Korea is a very patrilineal society. Lineage is all recorded through the father's line and so on. But still, it gives women certain range. In recent economic change and social change. So women are getting more, taking more charge of themselves, and they're saying that they don't necessarily have to get married.
All right. Well, we'll talk more about that in just a moment. We're exploring the anthropology of love today. My guests are Sonia Ryan, a professor of anthropology and international studies at the University of Iowa, and Teresa Downing-Madabeg, an associate professor of sociology at Iowa State. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and we're celebrating Valentine's Day today with an exploration of the anthropology of love. Joining me are Sonia Ryan. She's a University of Iowa professor of anthropology and international studies. Teresa Downing-Madabeg is also here. She's an associate professor of sociology in Iowa State University. They've both made the exploration of love and marriage and sex and all of the things that surround it part of their careers. And we'd love to hear from you today as well. If there's something about the human animal and romantic love that you find baffling, give us a call and ask about it. Or if you found love in an unusual way and would like to share your story, we'd love to hear from you. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we were talking about the 1950s, how things changed dramatically in the 1950s as far as what young people were capable of and what the trajectory in life was in the post-World War II era, things changed again dramatically in the 1960s. Of course, that is when the sexual revolution took place. So, Teresa, tell us about how things changed with the idea of romantic love and, of course, a decoupling of sex with marriage, although, of course, we know that premarital sex took place before the 1960s. There was an assumption that if people engaged in intercourse, they would then at least marry after. So how did things change in the 60s?
Well, in the 60s, we did have the era of free love, and we had Woodstock, of course, which we, you know, can all remember, at least go back to YouTube and watch a little bit of. And people were, you know, coupling sexually, even if they weren't in love in the 60s. But for the most part, to be honest, we didn't really stray that far from the values that we held in the 1950s. It's just that we became more open about our sexuality and we were more experimental with love and sex and also drugs, to just throw that in there. But we sort of settled back into a more stable and relatively traditional patterns of family life in the, you know, in the late 60s, 1970s. An interesting thing that happened, though, during that era was that many, many women decided that they wanted to go to work. They simply were not satisfied after World War II with being told to go back home and live this Ozzie and Harriet lifestyle. And many of them had become accustomed to working during the war and decided they wanted to go back to work after the 1950s era, in that 1960s burgeoning countercultural era. And during that era, then, it was an important time for women to start claiming some of their sexual freedom and start claiming some of their independence. In, you know, not only their sexual explorations, but also in choosing mates.
Well, and it also created a different drive somewhat in relationships. It, in a way, it decoupled this looking for a mate from procreation, because, of course, when women were seeking out careers, the idea of procreation was something that they wanted to have more control over.
Absolutely. And we have to remember, too, that birth control became widely available in the 1960s, which really unbound women from linking sex with reproduction. And that, in many ways, did facilitate the availability of birth control, women's freedom in the economic force. They're going to school at greater and greater levels, and even graduating from college, for that matter, facilitated their ability to decouple, as it were, love and sex, which was something that we traditionally thought was only in the domain of men.
And as, of course, the human animals are out seeking mates, seeking romantic love, they are sent out into the world by their primal urges, by the fact that we do within us have this need to procreate or this desire to procreate. And of course, although our brains have given us many other ideas about what we're actually doing, Sonia, as we're searching for a mate, what is driving us?
It's a very interesting question, isn't it? Because why does it have to be him or her? You know, these are not easy questions. Of course, you can say, well, I fell in love, but is there a reason behind it? Or should there be reason behind it? I don't know. Often in my anthropology of love class, I ask students, and I normally get same answer every time I offer it. I ask, okay, guys, which one would you like to marry? Someone who's from very similar cultural background as you, so you kind of know what other person might think, you know, tend to think and tend to do things in this way or that way. Or someone who's from very, very different culture and, you know, it's the relationship will be full of surprises and you're going to have to learn about each other. And students answer normally and predominantly is the first. They want to fall in love and marry someone who is just like them. So I ask them, I tell them, okay, why don't you marry your sister or your brother then? Because they do come from very similar background as you. And then they think I'm crazy. But these are interesting questions. Why not as close as your brother or sister, but then someone who is a bit like you? Why is that? And then, luckily, by the time the semester ends, they all start to think that maybe that doesn't have to be always the answer. But I really don't know. It's a very intriguing question. Why him? Why her?
Well, and it's interesting that the first reaction is that.
Yes.
But in practice, that's not what people seem to be looking for necessarily.
That is true, isn't it? I mean, it may be some, it's an intimidating thing, isn't it? To be in love with someone and to recognize that. Because if you love someone, obviously you realize that you have to give part of you. You're going to lose part of you. Instead, you may have part of him or her because it is a kind of fusion. And desire obviously leads you to even physically with him or her together, closer and all the time and for the rest of your life. But is that sometimes, and oftentimes young people feel that desire is actually driving them rather than they are totally in control. So that may be the trigger for them to answer. The answer tended to be the first one, the one that comes from the similar cultural background.
You're welcome to join our conversation. The number to call is 866-780-9100. You can also tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we have Will on the line in Ames right now. Hello, Will. Will, are you there? Perhaps we have not gotten our connection with Will right now. We'll see if we can get him on.
You, you
hello.
Can't hear me?
Now I can. Hi.
All right.
Hi, Will. What's your question?
Well, it's about casual sex in the campus environment is what I'm wondering about because I'm 23 years old. I was in the college environment for a while, and I've done lots of reading into the nature of casual sex on campus, and there's always this assumption in pretty much every survey that I've read on the subject, my students, that casual sex will eventually, at some point, lead to an actual relationship. But if you actually look into the statistics, this is something that never, hardly ever happens. And it's very interesting. There's one book I read called Sex and the Soul about campus relationships that starts out with a consciousness-raising group of graduate women, and they're discussing casual sex and realizing sort of abruptly that even though all of them are pretty much engaging in it, none of them are really enjoying it, and they were kind of assuming that everybody else was. So that's what I'd just like to hear about that from your callers, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Okay, thank you so much, Will. And Teresa, I know this is an area of expertise for you, so can you respond to Will's question?
Well, I think that he's right that for the most part, hooking up or otherwise known as, casual sex does not generally lead to a long-term love-based relationship in terms of, romantic love at first and then, transforming into a more committed and stable form of love in the future that involves companionship and a deep level of psychological and emotional intimacy. Indeed, research shows that today among young married couples, we are seeing rising rates of infidelity, and this is true for both men and women, and I believe that women are starting to catch up a little bit with men in that area. And I can't help but wonder whether the hookup culture and the promotion of casual sex on college campuses. Boston University came out with a campus magazine called Boing, I believe, that promotes casual sex and different kinds of sexual experimentation on college campuses. That's really taken off and spread all over the country to various universities. So, I would have to agree that students engage in quite a bit of risk behavior when it comes to the hookup culture, especially since alcohol is often involved. And they get into relationships, sexual relationships, immediately with people whom they really do not know. And it was interesting to me when I was doing my hookup study that I would ask the young men, well, would you ever date your hookup partner? When they were talking about their last hookup. And a lot of them said, no, I wouldn't. Some of them said yes. Some of the girls said yes. But what a thing I heard a lot from the guys when I asked them, well, who would you date? They would say, well, I would like to date someone who's smart and with whom I can have some really interesting conversations. So they were really looking for that psychological intimacy in a future prospective partner. So I guess I would have to say that I do share Will's concern that maybe promoting casual sex, and even though students don't do it as much as it seems in the mainstream media, they're really not hooking up every single day or every single weekend. I think that the idea of it is creating a little bit of malaise and distrust in relationships among college students. And there's a recent study that showed, too, that even college students who are in perceived monogamous relationships are oftentimes in relationships with people who are cheating with them by having oral, anal, or vaginal sex with another partner. So that puts their sexual health at risk as well.
When you talk about the hookup culture, and that's something we've started hearing about quite a bit in recent years, and of course the idea is that it is a casual sexual experience as opposed to dating and sex involved in a greater relationship. But how different is that really from what's been going on, say, college campuses for the last 20, 30 years?
Are you asking me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. How is that different?
How has it changed? How is the hookup culture different from what would have been going on in the 1980s, for example?
Well, that's a really good question. I think that what's different, and it's not as if it were not happening in the 1980s, because we all know that it was, that people were having one-night stands or, you know, having sex with people with whom they were friends and sometimes with casual partners as well. But I think one of the key things for us to think about today is the fact that it is the hookup culture is sort of being promoted as a cultural norm during this phase of the life course, if you know what I mean. And I think we're seeing a little more anonymity in relationships as well. And I can just give you an example. I can't say this happens all the time, but one person told me, for example, about a hookup experience that she had. And her roommate had met somebody on the internet and decided that she wanted to go to Des Moines to meet this guy. And the person, I'll just call her Sally, who was talking with me, decided to go along with the roommate just to make sure everything was cool. They went to Des Moines, met this guy, and he happened to have a friend there. So Sally went downstairs and had sex with him, and she didn't even know his name. So it's not that that kind of thing happens all the time, and it's not as if it didn't happen in the 1980s, but I really do think that there is a greater level of anonymity in the culture today, and I think that the idea of hooking up is being promoted through multiple forms of media and also accepted as something that you just do in today's culture, whereas before it was a little bit more discreet.
What do you think has driven this change, Teresa?
What I think has driven this change?
Yeah. Why do you think? Is it access to technology? Is it so people can connect with each other in more anonymous ways? Or is it, you know, pop culture showing us different role models? What's the difference?
Boy, if I could answer that question, I'd have another publication. Let's see here. What is the difference? Why are we doing this? Well, let's just look at a couple of factors. We see on college campuses, for example, we see a lot of dorms that are co-educational, and young men and women are living together in the same housing. They're together all night. There are lots of opportunities there to slip into somebody's room and, you know, and have a hookup. There's a lot of partying that's going on college campuses, and I think there's a lot of sensationalization of casual sex in the media. For example, if you look at Girls Gone Wild and, you know, some other shows, on TV, these little popular reality shows, you know, there are lots of them out there about hooking up and, you know, going to this, you know, beach house and spending the weekend with a bunch of kids and hooking up with whomever you will. I think that the media plays a huge role in it. And I also think another factor is that, at least in terms of gender relations, I think women are seeing that men have had this freedom traditionally to engage in casual sex. And in some ways, I hear some women telling me that they're claiming that same right If they're going to be used, they're going to use back. And I'm putting that in somewhat of a negative perspective there. But and it's not to say that some people don't go out and hook up and totally enjoy it and have a good time with their partners. But at the same time, I think what I'm seeing between the genders is a sense of mistrust in one another that's evolving out of this.
And I think that's something that we have seen, that idea of women taking on the role of men in dating, getting to be much more common in popular culture. And I want to broaden the conversation to talk about different cultures around the world. And I think that we're going to get to a break here in just a moment, so we can just start this a little bit. But Sonia, we've talked about how in many ways the rest of the world has followed the United States in changes in dating culture and the idea of self-determination in who one dates and who one marries. But are we also seeing this kind of shift around the world as far as the newer hookup culture?
No, I'm not sure. Actually, I was, as I was listening to Therese, I was a little shocked because it's just a couple of years ago that we were inundated with talks about the abstinence-only sex education. Mm-hmm. Is there any backlash, do you think, because of that rather top-down value imposition on young people that you just have not to, you just don't do it, just don't, do not do it until you are sure that you're going to marry this particular individual? It just almost sounds like there is a kind of reaction to that. Now, of course, in the Japanese. Oh, maybe I can talk about Japanese context
after the break.
Sure.
Thank you so much. Okay. My guests are Sonia Rang. She's a professor of anthropology and international studies at the University of Iowa. And Teresa Downing-Madabeg. She's an associate professor of sociology at Iowa State University. This is Talk of Iowa.
You, sweetie pie, all the day and night time, hear me sigh. I never had the least notion that I could fall with so much emotion.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about love. We're taking an in-depth view of the anthropology of love, the idea of romantic love, and the evolution of courtship and dating over the years. My guests today are Teresa Downing-Madabeg. She's an associate professor of sociology at Iowa State University, and Sonia Rang, who's a professor of anthropology and international studies at the University of Iowa. And Sonia, just before the break, we were trying to take a cross-cultural look. We were talking about very recent changes in dating culture or hookup culture among young people in the United States. And and you were going to tell us about Japan.
Sure. In Japan, I mean, in Japanese context, the casual sex is accommodated in different ways. It's not not necessarily on college campuses. The college campuses are very different in Japan from what we have here. And especially if we compare Ames or Iowa City to any of the Japanese college campuses, it's very different. They don't have this thing called college, campus town, for example. But of course, everybody knows that in Japan and in many other Asian countries, they have this thing called love hotels. So you do have an establishment that you can go there and pay a certain amount of money and then stay 2 hours and have sex and come out. Now, I'm not sure how much of that is used by young people rather than middle-aged people, or let's say purchased sex, if you like. If a man buys a prostitute, and they might use the love hotels. Now, college campuses are very difficult to, in that sense, nail down in terms of sexual and romantic activities. Most colleges in Japan, for example, are urban, and they are spread very broadly. But the casual sex, obviously, I think I am of impression that it is definitely increasing, whether one is college student or not. And yes, among young people. But I have to tell you, in Japan, so-called virginity was not important, traditionally speaking. It was very common, for example, in even early 20th century, to see that a woman gets betrothed and she gets married into a family. Now, they don't register her as married to their son yet until she actually becomes pregnant. Now, if she doesn't get pregnant, they might just send her back to her natal home. Then, on paper, she's never married. Now, whether physically she was virgin or not, it wasn't a question. Virginity becomes much more important after the U.S. occupation. So in some ways, Americans brought this concept of purity, pure love, and under the occupation, during the occupation time, the Japanese government organized this thing called the Purity Education Committee to how to educate young people about pure love. It was done in very gender disparity kind of way. So purity was imposed on girls, and then boys, when they bought the prostitutes, that was not a question, that was not a problem. But female students were given all this education about if they do lots of sports, if they do radical sports, your hymen might be damaged. That kind of very sexualized and almost biological education about their purity. Now, that is changing, definitely. Those are 1950s, as we were talking a little early on. And that is definitely changing. And then it's almost... In some ways, ironically, Japan is doing one circle. It's coming back to the time where virginity wasn't that important. Because unlike, for example, Korea or China, Japanese do not have very strong patrilineal tradition. It's, as everybody knows, virginity becomes much more important in patrilineal societies where for father, the daughter's virginity is a very pricey commodity to sell through the marriage, you know, the matchmaking. And so on. So yes, it is changing, but in Japanese case, it is showing some interesting full circle, if you like.
That is interesting. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Brad is on the line in Iowa City now. Hello, Brad.
Hi.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Interesting conversation. I guess one of the things I just noticed is, well, it's a discussion on Valentine's Day. I assumed it would be about love. It seems to be a lot about sex, which I guess, I don't know, is that necessarily a part of or not a part of love? But the question I had is, I heard the conversation about casual sex. I don't know if I understood it, but it sounded kind of moralistic. And so I guess my question was, as humans and as an animal or a biological being, is this idea of abstain from sex until you get married and the fact that we do wait later, oftentimes into our 30s to get married, is that actually contrary to who we are biologically? And then the other question I had that occurred to me is, in talking about casual sex, one of the things that I hadn't heard was the introduction of birth control, which I think had, to me, it seemed like it had huge, enormous impact in that one could get involved in sexuality without it actually being a procreative kind of act. So just to throw out those questions and thoughts and take my answer.
All right. Yeah, you brought up a lot of different subjects, Brad, so we'll try to touch on them. But I want to get to the bigger question of, is sex part of love or not part of love, in a couple of minutes. Let's start with the fact that we are, in our society, waiting, many of us, waiting a lot longer to marry and waiting a lot longer to procreate. Sonia, is this a case where the human animal is fighting its own biology?
I'm not sure. I'm not the biological anthropologist, so I can't really comment on that with any concrete data. But it seems that the kind of global trend, when the industrialization gets complete, and then when the society enters this so-called post-capitalist or affluent, very affluent phase, where everybody is educated, and let's say modernity takes over, so people become very self-critical, self-reflexive agent rather than just be the passive agent, then yes, it looks like, doesn't it, that there seems to be a correlation between that kind of level of development of the society and the later age in terms of marrying and procreating. And if I can add a little more, then drastically low level of birth rate, and then also the fewer occurrences of the marriage itself. It seems to be there's a correlation between that.
That's interesting. And Teresa, let's talk about this question of sex and love, because this the hookup culture we were talking about earlier, a large part of that is really decoupling love and sex. What do love and sex have to do with one another, and can we decouple them?
Well, of course, here in the U.S. and in many countries around the world, love and sex are and can be decoupled. It really depends on your personal values and your sexual preferences. I think there's a great deal of diversity. Here in the U.S., we still have fairly conservative religious traditions that would, you know, honor sex only in the context of marriage. We have many young people on our college campuses who are somewhat religious, who aren't necessarily doing that, but are involved in committed relationships involving sex and sometimes hooking up as well. And then at the other extreme, we have a number of young people and even adults, you know, my age and older people for that matter, who are, you know, have no problem whatsoever with hooking up and casual sex. But there's one thing here that I'd like to add that I think is sort of fascinating. And I don't know if you've ever heard of the Dutch sleepover, but in the Netherlands, there's this thing called the Dutch sleepover, wherein Dutch parents became a little bit concerned about their kids going out and hooking up randomly with just anyone or any friend or acquaintance for that matter. And they've really tried to encourage kids, and this is true in much of Western Europe as well, to have sex at least in the context of a committed relationship. And Western European countries have actually done much, much better than the U.S. at educating youth about safer sex. And as a result, they have much lower rates of unintended pregnancies, extremely low rates of sexually transmitted diseases. And so I think that what's happening in America, we're seeing a little more of this decoupling of love and sex than we have in some other places. But getting back to the Dutch sleepover, some Dutch parents will actually have their sons or daughters, girlfriend or boyfriend, come over to their home, spend the evening with them, have dinner together, and then actually sleep over in the same bed, knowing that they're going to have sex that night.
A very, very different culture.
Absolutely. And I just think it's fascinating that in some cultures where we are more open, and getting back to the biological basis, where we are more open about young people's sexuality and the need to protect them, teach them how to be safe, there's a concurrent interest in also teaching them about relationships. And, you know, hopefully encouraging them to, you know, think about sexual intimacy in the context of a trust-based relationship. At the same time, however, I mean, you know, we have to realize that here in the U.S. it's a very kind of isolated, has some very unique characteristics. And in much of the world, prostitution is very common. I lived in Japan myself for a couple of years, and my first husband was Japanese. And when I was living there, I learned that, you know, it was not at all unusual for husbands to have mistresses. I taught English with a professional man while I was there. And one day he invited me to go out to dinner with his wife and his mistress and himself. And, you know, maybe being that open about it wasn't so popular, but certainly prostitution, mistresses, love hotels, and meeting there were very much a part of Japanese culture and still are today. And in fact, I was reading recently, Time Asia partnered with CNN to offer a special series on sex in Asia, which is available on the internet. And I was surprised to learn that there's this new, and I forget what they call it. Sonia, you might have to help me here. Mm-hmm. There's this new trend wherein Japanese schoolgirls in high school, for example, if they want to earn a little extra money, they can actually pick up their cell phones and text these older businessmen and arrange to meet them at a love hotel and have sex and get paid, mm-hmm. make a little cash on the side. Yeah. So, and there's been this sort of fetish or fascination with schoolgirls, you know, in this country. And I remember when I was living there, I saw a lot of TV programs involving like schoolgirls and, you know, having relationships with their teachers or some older men or that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think in much of Latin America, in many Southeast Asian countries and many sub-Saharan African countries, you see a greater, I think, openness regarding the various ways in which people can engage in casual sex. And in not all of these countries has that practice resulted in optimal public health outcomes, and that's another concern sure. altogether.
Well, and it also sounds like the kind of hookup culture we were talking about in the United States, where in many ways gender is being neutralized, where women can behave as stereotypically men have behaved in the past. When you were talking about the culture in Japan, it does not sound like gender is a neutral issue there.
Probably not. No. And it is interesting that this that's called Enjo Kosai. That's in Japanese. I translate that as aid date.
Aid date.
Yeah, enjo means aid or to help. And then kosai is to date. But it's a controversial term. And it's, yes, because of the government crackdown, it's gotten quite a bit reduced nowadays. But you see the pop-up of that similar pattern of younger girls actively seeking to exchange their sexual service with payment. This kind of service, this kind of activities, you can now see in places like Korea or Philippines and in other Asian, in Southeast Asian countries. That is true. I'm not sure if that tells us that these societies have more tolerance about casual sex. I am not certain about that. Each country has different background for the arrival of this kind of culture. It is true. Some Japanese girls studied that because they wanted to have Gucci bags and Louis Vuitton bags, and then their parents wouldn't pay for those expensive stuff. But it is also true that in places like Korea, that very underprivileged and girls from very poor and broken families, they tend to have to do that, take that option, because there is no other choice.
And that's something that we see worldwide.
Right, exactly. Yes. So it's a little hard to say whether these societies have larger tolerance towards the casual sex or not, or has it got a lot more to do with the global economic inequality? I'm not too sure.
Well, there are so many more things that I would love to talk to both of you about. One of the things that I really wanted to talk about today also is the relationship of love and marriage. We got an email that says, for several hundred years in literature, romantic love has been outlaw love rather than love within marriage. Is this distinction consistent with what you've seen? And we have just a moment left today, but we do think about love and marriage, particularly in the United States. These things go hand in hand. Is that the case throughout the world, Sonia?
With a bit of exaggeration, let me say, I think we are the exception.
Yes.
I'm glad, Teresa, you agree. the more norm that we find in the world is that romantic love does not necessarily have to be led to the marriage. It's a little different. But that does not mean that people marry without love. That doesn't mean that. But I think these are a little different types of loves, I think.
I mean, there are many more things we could talk about. Teresa, mm-hmm. did you have something quickly that you wanted to add to that?
Well, I just wanted to add that in many cases, you know, in Japan, for example, and in other countries where arranged marriage is popular, sometimes people fall in love after they get married.
Sure.
But here, definitely, romantic love comes first, and it's a rare example in the world.
Well, Teresa and Sonia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And happy Valentine's Day to both of you.
Thank you. Same to you.
Happy Valentine's Day.
With me today were Teresa Downing-Mattebeg. She's an Iowa State University Associate Professor of Sociology, and Sonia Rung, University of Iowa Professor of Anthropology and International Studies. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. We had technical assistance today from John Pemble, Michael Yeager, and Brian Dow. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up tomorrow on the program, we're going to take a look at the history of Zimbabwe. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.
O is for the only one I see. V is very, very extraordinary. E is even more than anyone that you adore can love. Is all that I can give to you. Love is more than just a game for two. Two in love can make it. Take my heart and please don't break it. Love was made for me and you.